Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat. I don't know how often we do it. A podcast on the Django Web Framework. Carlton Gibson joined us over by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And today we've got with us James Spadafora and Andre Prado from Industrial Light and Magic, who are going to talk to us about all things of how Django's used in wonderful world of audio visual and such. So thanks for coming on. This is really exciting to have you on.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Fine. So let's kick off. Industrial Light and Magic, you do really cool films. So how on earth is Django involved in that? How did you get into programming? What's your backstory? How does Django play a role in what you do? Andre, you go
sure,
first.
Sure, I can go first. So I actually graduated in computer engineering. I started working in the hardware industry, and then I've changed industries a couple of times and end up in visual effects almost by accident. And then it's been like 7 years now since I've been to visual effects. And, a lot of people don't know anything about visual effects, like I didn't, but we actually have this massive infrastructure to render frames, right? We have like petabytes of storage, thousands of CPUs in a farm to do batch processing. We have a bunch of services. We have many data centers, and they're all there to produce these great pictures that we see in the screen and that we don't even know what they are, how they are made.
Yeah, can I ask, when you say you've got these massive data, are they like in the basement in the office, or are they in the cloud somewhere? That's a lot of compute.
It's a lot of compute. Yeah. No, we mostly have our own data centers, and we have our own connections between the different data centers. So we have data centers in Sydney, San Francisco, Vancouver, Singapore, London, basically everywhere we have an office. We've also been using the cloud a little bit recently, but cloud ends up being very expensive for us. Like our workstation has 200 gigs of RAM and 64 cores to be able to open those heavy scenes and those, do some rendering. So you can imagine how the cloud, can be very expensive when you're paying for those sort of machines and very high-end GPUs too.
You don't get that on the AWS free plan then?
Not
at all.
Well, Carlton and I, as a side note, both got the new MacBooks with the A1 Max chip, and yeah, but now I feel inadequate hearing about 200.
I've downloaded Blender, so like I'm almost there, right? That's
you are one step ahead of me. Yeah, I basically come from, more recently, more DevOps, backend, systems engineering, and I actually don't have a lot of the knowledge in the proper, visual effects, and, I've been in the industry for a while, I help people with workflows and whatnot, but I think, James has been much closer to the product than I have, so maybe that's a good segue for you, Spad.
Yeah, sure. So I graduated from Savannah College of Art and Design with a Master's of Visual Effects, and I started at ILM right out of school, working as what we call a technical assistant, which is a way of saying I worked from midnight to 10 a.m. watching these renders on these massive machines that Andre was talking about. And then, followed the support path role, helping artists troubleshoot issues with their scenes, until eventually I moved into the production tools team, where we develop tools for interacting with data, such as like what shots need to be done, what tasks need to be done, generating media, those sorts of things.
Can I ask what do you study in that degree? Because I know, Andre, you gave a fantastic PyCon talk in the show notes on sort of the pipeline. And, James, I can see fluent Python on your bookshelf behind you, so I know we're going to talk about Python, but what does that curriculum look like? Because I have no idea what that would entail.
Sure. It was a mix between art and programming. So we learned, how to use visual effects software, create images and render them. Naturally, I kind of gravitated more towards the technical concepts, which is how I ended up in the position I'm in now. We did things such as learning to write shaders, which are programs that determine how light interacts with surfaces, as well as just, compositing, putting images together, all kinds of things.
Now, would that be like C++ versus Python? Because I know, Andre, just from your talk, you mentioned that a lot of the engines themselves are written in C++, but the glue that puts them together is typically in Python. Is that correct, James?
That's true. We did do a little bit of C++ in that program, if I remember correctly. But we never got into like writing full-fledged renderers.
Sure.
It's more like a computer science thing. You could think of it as like the program was learning to use the end result of those tools, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think to give an overview, like you can imagine, I think the majority of code in Visual Effects is Python by a large degree. And all those renders and C++, simulations and whatever needs to be super fast rendered in C++ offers a Python API. So basically every tool that we use, you have like a Python binding, a Python API that you can import into your environment and you can interact with the scene in real time via Python. Let's say, you're making a space battle and you have a spaceship, then through Python, you can, create 10 spaceships instead using an API and rotate them and change, their texture or what have you, all via Python APIs, very similar to how you import requests or what have you, but you actually import the DCC, we call DCC Digital Content Creator APIs.
Yeah, we're just importing the Millennium Falcon.
In your talk, Andre, you had import Maya, and you had some examples of that. I have to jump in. I told my wife I was interviewing you all, and she's a huge Mandalorian fan, and she was like, "What about that huge screen they use to film it? Right, the volume, I think." Just to like skip ahead, which I believe uses Unreal Engine, which is like a video game for the background. And then would that still use Python to move things around? Because I've seen videos where they can, right there, change things.
Yeah, I think interesting you mentioned that because we were just starting a new, what we call Stagecraft studio in Vancouver. And SPAD has actually been part of setting that up. Yes, definitely. It's not... As far as I'm aware, we haven't been using Unreal as much. We have our own render engine that we wrote in-house for reasons. And I don't think I'm the most qualified person to talk about that. But for sure, there is Python there. We run our own software that we wrote in-house, and there is Python bindings for all the different things. I do think a lot of the really heavy lifting is done in C++, though. We have some genius engineers working on that side of things. I don't know if you have anything to add, Spad.
No, I think you summed it up pretty well. We have a lot of engineers writing some great tools for interacting with the screens. We also have we've created interfaces like on, I don't know how much in detail I can go, but
this is a technical podcast.
We've created
so
interfaces.
Go deep.
Yeah, I meant like legally.
Oh, but, well, that too. We can edit it out if
that's it. Yeah, no one listens. It's fine.
Well, we can cut this if it doesn't work, right? So, but we've developed like interfaces on the iPad that lets
That's on the video I saw. I saw that on the volume.
Oh, is it?
There's,
oh, okay.
It's from 2020. It was showing someone with the iPad and saying they were moving it around and showing the screen moving. So that's out there.
Correct. Yeah. All right. Well, that's good. then I can go into detail on that. Yeah, so typically we'll have someone on set with the iPad, and what they'll do is they'll manipulate the light in the scene. So in typical film production, if you wanted to change the lighting, you would need to like move your lights around. But with the volume, what we're able to do is with the iPad, create these squares of light up on the walls to illuminate the scene. And that allows the director to get much faster feedback. And all the tooling around that I believe is written in Python to kind of stream that information over to our proprietary software.
Because it's all LEDs, right? It's the 21-foot screen and then also the ceiling, right? So there's no actual lights, right? It's just LEDs everywhere, pretty much?
I'm actually not sure,
to
be honest, how much practical lighting versus the LED wall. But I know that we do use the LED wall a lot to manipulate the light in real time as we're working.
And a suit of armor is pretty bad for that. Sorry, Carlton. I'm just so geeking out, right? Isn't that also last point? Isn't that also true that like lighting is super hard, but then you have a reflective surface, like that really magnifies more than skin, right? The issues.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think we could get as good looking results without the volume, because the reflections in real time on the Mandalorian suit of armor, like that's all from the wall. in the old days, we probably would have used a green screen, and it would have been kind of tough to do that. So,
yeah, and I think it's also worth noting that we've been using DeWalt for a lot of projects, not just Mandalorian, but for example, the last Batman movie used some of our technologies, and yeah, we have a lot of things in production using that, which is super cool. It's like reinventing filmmaking to some degree.
Absolutely.
Carlton, you say...
It's quite funny because James and Andre, for listeners at home, James and Andre are in Vancouver and Will's in Boston. I'm in Spain. So like they've got a nice little chat and I keep trying to butt in, but there's this nice latency, so I can't ever get it. It's fine, you know, Will, you just carry on. What I wanted to ask about was the change over the last, say, decade or longer in terms of, because you've used lots of phrases like real time and you're talking about having an iPad in hand and being able to drag components around, and that's just raw processing power, right? That's stuff that wouldn't have been possible, you know, 5-10 years ago or even, you know. Can you talk about the change in the technology? And let me give you one example. Was that I saw a line from the Pixar people about rendering Toy Story 4, and they were able to render it basically in real time as they were producing it, versus when they did Toy Story originally 20 years previously. You know, it would take several hours to render a single frame.
Yeah, I think it's, yeah, for sure, technology has evolved a lot in the last decade. But I do think movies keep getting more complex too, and we keep having higher resolutions. So it's almost like, doesn't matter how much it evolves, artists on computer graphics are always using everything we've got. So
it's like,
we definitely do a lot more.
Microsoft Word always takes 7 seconds to open, right? No matter what decade you're in.
What's like getting an extra bin in the kitchen? You just end up with more rubbish. Like,
and just the amount of visual effects too that is used nowadays, right? Basically, every single show you watch on Netflix or Amazon Prime or what have you has an immense amount of VFX shots, probably more than movies than had like 5 or 10 years ago. Even though, you know, you don't even notice it, it's out there making for a very realistic experience.
So I want to talk about the pipeline, but maybe we could just jump to, where does Django fit in all this, right? Like, let's start with that, right? So you have this whole C++ things glued together with Python. You've got massive rendering and databases. Where is the Django small bit in all that?
I think that's a great question. I think, you know, I'll give a little bit of a historic perspective, plus, you know, And SPAD can get into the details. That works for you, SPAD. Cool. But I think, historically, you know, visual effects was just a bunch of Python scripts on a big shared folder. And then you add that folder to your Python path and you version those Python scripts. I think that defines, a visual effects pipeline to some degree. And I'm talking about, you know, millions of lines of code. So it's not like some Python script. It's actually like terabytes of Python scripts. I would say that with things getting more complex, we have a multiple data center doing more shots, we needed to scale that to some degree. And I think a good way of scaling it is, you know, decoupling a little bit of the client side dependencies from the business logic behind the service. And that's where services start making an appearance in visual effects, I believe. And also, you know, some people want some fancy web UIs done on React instead of like Qt or, you know, some more desktop-based apps, which also a server helps with. So I think that transition has been happening in the visual effects industry a little bit slowly towards services. And I think, you know, historically at ILM, we are using, each group has a lot of independent to choose their own tools and frameworks. And we end up with a lot of different teams speaking different tools. For example, a team would use Tornado, a team would use Flask. And it made it super hard to be cohesive, I feel, how we deal with authentication, how we deal with databases. So we sort of standardized on using Django to building some of those services that abstract the business logics away. We set some common libraries that we use, like Django REST, for example, and other things, like how we connect with LDAP and et cetera. We just made the process of developing a service more streamlined that allowed us, you know, to have Ansible plays or Docker files that are standard across the teams and et cetera. To some specific examples on how Django is used, maybe SPAD, you can go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Actually, if you don't mind, I just want to expand a little bit on what you were saying about the scripts in the pipeline and whatnot. So, before I was on this team, I was on another team that worked as kind of the go-between between the projects we were working on and the engineering teams. And we have some of the smartest artists in the world working at ILM. And as a result, they like to, write Python code. So managing all the scripts written by all these different people across all these different teams has always been quite a challenge for us. And also that move from Qt, because all of our third-party software, Maya, Nuke, was all written in Qt. So that's what we were using for a long time before we made the shift to using web UIs and whatnot. To get back to the specifics of the Django stuff, one area we're using Django is to deal with subscription management. So for an artist, the typical workflow is they'll do some piece of work and write out some media, and then they will submit that media for review for either the director or their supervisors. And we have a lot of artists submitting a lot of media, and trying to route that media to the right people is a bit of a challenge, because we have like five different sites all working on different projects with different people. So we developed a service that lets users subscribe to different tasks based on what the artist is doing. So for example, if I'm a director, I could say I only want to see lighting media from San Francisco. So they can go into this web UI and edit these filters. And every time the artist submits media, it goes to the correct people based on the filters that they've created.
Yeah, filtering and organizing stuff is really hard. Even there's this site, djangopackages.org, that Jeff Tripla has taken over, that we were just going through grids and opting into things. And I can't even imagine how complex it is to actually do that at the scale you're you're talking about. I mean, can you... because with code, you can use version control and Git. Like, how do you track changes on a image or audio file? Is there a way, or what's the process for that?
Well, we typically don't track changes on like the specific files. What we do is we track submissions. So if the artist, they'll submit something and they'll get some notes that are attached to that version. The artist will then act on those notes and submit a new version. And we keep track of all those versions associated with like a task that needs to be done.
Yeah, I think in general terms, visual effects companies usually have this thing called an asset system, which is very much in the core of the company. And basically, whenever someone publishes a new version of a model, a simulation, a rigging, that's a new asset. And then you basically track some metadata with the asset, a bit like S3. And you have like versions for the assets. You have dependencies between assets. So let's say I'm compositing some scene and the model changed or whatever, then I get a notification like, hey, there's a more up-to-date version of the Iron Man model. Do you want to update it or what have you? And there's a bunch of things like that that we have to... Tracking data across the pipeline is super important. As I've mentioned, we have a lot of storage and those assets are massive. Like a texture can have like terabytes, and it can be very cumbersome to keep the disk space tidy, as we have many shows and artists and assets being produced.
Well, Carlton, we always talk about, is something internet scale, and like, I think we need a new vocabulary for VFX scale, because it's just...
But it's so good, because you've watched these over the last year or so, I've watched these new generation of Macs come out, and they're kind of massively overpowered for web development. There's just more megs of RAM and more GPUs than you really need. But then when you get into doing actual visual effects, that's where these sort of superpower computer systems really do are needed.
We definitely have scenes that, just to open it, you need 200 gigs of RAM just to open the scene.
Yeah, fantastic.
Several questions. One, and I'm just cribbing so much from your talk, Andre, because I watched it a couple of times. It's such a good introductory talk.
Thank you.
One of the things you mentioned, because I think you gave the talk in 2019, and you mentioned that Python 2 was dominant in 2018, and there was going to be a switch to Python 3. We certainly have lived through that switch in the Django world. Is that is that switch complete, or like what version of Python are you using, or is it all over the place? Because it's kind of all over
the place
in the Django world, but it's pretty much all Python 3.
Yeah. That's a great topic. I think, you know, the DCC is like Maya, Nuke, and other software the VisualFX artists use. They ship with a Python interpreter, and that Python interpreter has still been the standard being 2.7. There are some of them that are in Python 3 nowadays, or, you know, I feel the industry is slowly moving towards Python 3. We've certainly spent huge effort on migrating to Python 3 recently, a lot of those scripts. And as I've mentioned, we're talking about millions and millions of lines of code from Python to migrate. So it's very hard to justify the business need for it, I feel, because, you know, ILM has been around for 40 years, and we have a lot of old code lying around, and, you know, but they are working in the business function.
Right, so end of life 2 years ago doesn't matter. You know, it's still, as Carlton and I joke, every code is, like, just good enough to not break.
Yeah, I'll say, though, that with the new versions of those tools being Python 3 only, that puts pressure on companies to move to Python 3. All of our service-side code, or most of it, is written in Python 3, I would say. When you don't have a dependency in the runtime of the artist software, which is Python 2, we can do Python 3. So really, we're trying to make all of our code compatible with 2 and 3. All new services start on 3. But yeah, I think we are winning that battle. Slowly, Spad, I don't know if there's anything you want to add.
No, I think we're definitely winning that battle. We just had a big push across our teams to convert all that artist code over from Python 2 to Python 3 compatible. And it's given us an opportunity to do a lot of house cleaning, which has been great, like archiving stuff that isn't used anymore. And it's been an interesting exercise to figure out what's used and what's not. I think in hindsight, it would be great to have more analytics on a lot of stuff. So I think that's a great thing to build in if you have a lot of software to maintain.
On this topic, Carlton, you know, as a fellow, you know, maybe just for listeners, what was the 2 to 3 transition like for Django? Because smaller scale, but still pretty massive amount of work.
Lasted forever. I mean, like, you know, I was maintaining packages like Django Filter, Django REST Framework for the whole, you know, over that period. And you were just supporting 2.7, you know, and then 3.2, 3.3, 3.4, you know, as it started coming out, and you were running the test suite against each of them. And it was a real, you know, at the end, it got to be a real pain. It was like, oh, are we really still supporting 2.7 here? And then I remember when it was like, no, actually, it's end of life now. We're starting to drop it. And it was like, ah, oh, what a weight.
It's so liberating. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it really was. And they got it where you had this nice world where you could write library code, which was both Python 2 compatible and Python 3 compatible. And it sort of went on. It was like, yeah, this is doable. This is no problem. But when you could delete all those objects, you know, support from objects. And when I can't remember the things, and to get rid of 6, this, you know, you weren't able to call the string functions. You had to use the 6 compatibility shim. And it was like, and when all of that dropped away, it was just like, oh, like a breath of fresh air. It really was. But you still, you know, you break something which is Python 2 compatible, and you still get issue reports opened as like, oh, you've dropped Python 2. And so, well, Python 2 has been end of life for a couple of years, so I don't feel too bad about dropping it. But clearly there's still lots of people using it. Right? It's still really out there.
And then what are you and Marius, what versions of Python are you testing for Django now? Like 3.5, 3? Like, because I know you have to...
No, 3. So, but Django 2.2 is 3.6 through till, I don't know, 3.9 or something. And then Python 3, Django 3 is 3.8 up.
But
I think
much smaller space to cover than, as you say, all the visual effects area. And yeah, shipping with 2.
Yeah.
Well,
we've got like 30,000 tests and, you know, so many lines of code. We're not talking terabytes of code. I mean, so, okay, here's a good question. Tests, right? Because so I'm a digital artist, and I write up a little Python script to manipulate my 3D scene I've got in front of me. It works, and it, you know, I can do exactly what I want, and I've bashed it together, but I haven't written any tests for that ever, Is that
yeah
that's pretty common.
So how do you address that?
So usually we use artists,
right? Okay.
For their scripts.
Do it live. Do it live. Yeah.
Do it live. Yeah. So what we found with a lot of the artist scripts is you kind of have to have a understanding of the software to test it. This was a good exercise for our team because a lot of them hadn't touched artist tools, so they got to learn a little bit in that regard. Ideally, I mean, all of our software that we write on our team has tests for the most part. And that's super important to us and something we want to continue doing going forward, because it just makes things so much more maintainable and upgradable. For artists' scripts, it's a little hard to enforce because we have a bit of a wild west of scripts built into our pipeline where anyone can commit anything and use it. I don't know if you want to expand on that, Andre.
Yeah, it feels a little bit chaotic, and it is, but it kind of works. We have a software management system that we wrote in-house, a little bit like, you know, PEEP and VirtualEnv, but it's our own implementation. And that basically tracks artist software so that you can version up, version down, you can easily roll back. Like rolling back software for us is like a 1 second operation. You basically change a sim link to point to the previous version. So at the end of the day, we do release, you know, hundreds of times a day those scripts and software. So we release software quite often, and we make it easy to roll back. And for the artist software in particular, in the Python 3 migration, we in our software management system, we added a check that it basically tries to compile the software to Python 3. And if it fails to compile, that means, you know, you cannot release it anymore because it's not Python 3 compatible. So we enforced at that level. We didn't did the unit test or whatever, because it's just not doable, I think, for our problem right now, our problem space. But we did enforce that it at least compiles with both Python 3 and 2 so that you can make sure that it is compatible. And if not, you have to do a / force, or some people still do it, but you know, at least we track everything. We have like a web UI.
Yeah, sudo / force, you know, make it. Well, yeah. That's something like that. You know, testing in our realm, Carlton, right? I mean, I've often asked you for advice because there's at one extreme is test-driven development, do the test first, 100% test coverage. And then there's also, you know, happy path programming, test it. And then when something breaks, write another test. That's more of the iterative approach, I think, Carlton, that you've advised to me at least as well on this.
It depends as well. Like, you know, to test even in the quite, let's say, mundane realm of web development, let's call it, where you're testing a web UI, that's hard to test. It really is. You know, you spend a lot of time writing, you know, UI tests, and they're really flaky and they fall apart.
Yeah, integration tests. They're
to try and do that with a sort of, you know, a graphical editor like Blender or whatever. I don't know what the artists use, but that kind of, you know, 3D environment tool, that I can't imagine it's even feasible to get off the ground testing that. Can't imagine there are tests. It's even possible.
Yeah. I think one thing that's bad mention is that we have a lot of people writing code that are not trained software developers or don't care about software developers. I hope they care about software developers, but not about software. You know, at the end of the day, our business is to ship pretty pictures for the movies. It's not to ship software too, right? So I think that there is a trade-off there. And yeah, usually we just need to know how to manage it. You know, if it's some very critical service like the asset system, you better expect it has a great test coverage because you can bring down the whole studio globally if you, you know, release a bug. And, you know, Marvel is not going to change the release date of a movie because we can't render it or whatever. So, you know, some very core pieces of the software, I think, do have the love and care they deserve, but it's more scripty side of things, which is a lot of the software we have to maintain. It doesn't need or follow the same scrutiny. Maybe that's the word.
I mean, I think the phrase you've hit there is it doesn't need it. This is a script I'm using to manipulate a 3D scene that I've got in front of me in a GUI program. I don't need it to be, you know, unit tested in the same way. It's a tool to help me with what I'm doing, not you know, core bit of my business logic. That whereas the Django app you were describing, where you're doing the subscription tracking to asset changes, that sounds like the sort of thing that would be susceptible to, you know, much more rigorous testing.
Of course, those script tends to evolve, and then people start using each other's script, and then they build a library around this. Fast forward 3 years, that random script is now a core part of the business.
It's like the mythical Excel macro that, you know, no one can.
That's a good analogy.
The whole multi-billion-dollar business runs on this one Excel sheet.
Well, I had a question about infrastructure, which this is just like the layman's version, but I think it's somewhat famous that Pixar with Toy Story 2, right? They lost it, except some art, like producer was on maternity leave and had a copy on her computer. I'm just curious for you as professionals, what does that story say to you? Because hopefully that's still not possible. I mean, I guess you couldn't store a movie on a computer, but like, how do you test or not cover someone like, you know, nuking everything, right? Because that's a pretty crazy story. I think they actually thought they didn't have it for a number of days. And they're...
So we had a bug a couple of years ago when we started using with Docker, and someone ran sudo docker rm, you know, to remove the container after it executes. And then it mounted an FS share that had a show, and then it deleted parts of the show. But we could catch up it. We caught up it on time. That must have been like 5 years ago. I think it was a bug in Docker itself. We do have, you know, a big NFS storage, and we have policies for backup. So I do think we are covered there. But, you know, some of our data centers use tapes for backups. It is a lot of storage. I don't know. We have software to do the operations. Like an artist who doesn't, you know, as artists don't have root, and they won't be able to RMRF a show partition, for example. They have to use some tools to do this cleanup and et cetera, that check their permissions and whatnot. Everything is tracked, or almost everything is tracked. Spad, I don't know if you want to add to it.
No, I think you covered it pretty well. I mean, the tape backups are definitely an interesting area. Fun fact about the tape machine, that's actually the inspiration from, I don't know if you guys ever seen Rogue One, the movie. Do you remember the giant machine that took the tape out and she looks at it in the movie? Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, that's actually inspired by our tape machine.
Fantastic.
In the basement of
is that Rogue One behind you? Or maybe that's Star Wars.
Oh, no, that's the last Skywalker. One, Episode 9, Rise of Skywalker. Yeah,
Rise of Skywalker.
It was my first credit on a Star Wars movie. I think, James, you signed here somewhere.
Yeah, you got everybody up there to sign it.
So that was my first Star Wars at ILM, and we did some pretty amazing work there on the visual effects side.
So that was a nice inside joke, though, James, on the getting that in there on the process for the visual effects folks.
Just a little nerd out moment. It must be quite awesome to be credited on a Star Wars film.
Yeah, totally. They're for eternity.
Yeah, definitely.
So how does someone get into this if they don't have a master's degree? I mean, Andre, you said you found your way in. I mean, so let's say someone knows Python. What advice would you give them, or what, you know, how do you go the technical route into?
Apply.
Yeah. Well, then what do you look for, right? How do you screen? Like, what kind of?
So, I think visual effects has a lot of different departments. For example, Spad mentioned he started as a technical assistant, which is a TA. You don't really need a lot of advanced Python or visual effects to get there. You mostly need script stuff. That's usually the entry level of the industry, where you're going to be tasked with ingesting some tapes of some data from the client into our pipeline, watching some render jobs, seeing if they're having issues and bugs, taking too long. And then you start scripting some stuff to make your job easier. And eventually you make your way through the pipeline as a pipeline TD, which is a pipeline technical director, or in core pipeline, our group, or in R&D. There's usually a little bit of mentorship there, and depends where you want to go. Some technical assistants end up being going to editorial or being an artist, but I think that's the entry level. However, if you do have some experience with software, visual effects is always hiring people. And if you don't have visual effects experience, that's totally fine. I'd say just go to like ILM VFX careers. You can just put on Google, we are hiring right now across all levels to join our team. If you have the traditional backend, full stack experience, I'm sure you're going to be a huge asset to our team, and we can teach you the specifics of visual effects. We don't expect you to know that. Hopefully that answers the question. Spad, do you want to add something?
Yeah, I can expand on that. ILM has a wonderful culture of fostering talent and empowering people. As Andre mentioned, I started out working midnight to 10, and the most Python experience I had was writing scripts, that monitored a farm. And fast forward 7 years, and I'm writing Django services, deploying with Ansible and Docker. All of this was learned through ILM. So we are always looking for people at all levels, and we love growing from within. So apply.
Yeah, that's great to have training. I mean, even at megacorps for traditional software, it's pretty rare to actually have it, from what I've heard. But sorry, Carlton, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, there's nothing visual effects specific about deploying with Ansible, say, doing DevOps, spinning up a new server, provisioning it, those kind of things. There's nothing, FX-y about that. So you don't know, you don't have to be an FX artist to do that stuff.
Totally. I do think it helps. Like if you know how a visual effects pipeline actually operates, or you can talk with artists and understand their pain points. Helpful, right? But it's something you can learn in the job. And, we have product owners for some of our products, internal products, that will be that interface with artists and technology. You got to talk with a lot of people. We're very collaborative. So, yeah, if you are interested in this domain, I can say it's pretty fun. I wasn't even aware it existed. And I absolutely, had a blast working on this domain It's not your boring CRUD app that a lot of devs complain about.
all the web devs. After a couple of years, it's kind of like the same thing. Well, but so on that, on the career thing, so... Because James, so you've been at ILM your whole career, but Andre, you started off in hardware. You've been at a couple other visual effects places. I guess I'm just curious. So in traditional, in web software, people kind of bounce around a lot. It sounds like maybe at ILM, it's not so much the case. But you, Andre, because you came in a different route, you've made that transition. So I guess I'm curious what causes someone to move around, right? Is it new challenges? Is it new learning environments? Or I assume salary as well. Like what's give us a sense of that world and the career tracks. If you're not from the
inside ILM.
Well, no, if you're not inside ILM. So how did you first get into VFX? And then you have been at, when you gave your talk, you were at a different effects house.
At Method Studios. Yeah. I was there for, I think, a year and a half at the time. I don't know. I think I was just looking for a job. I was working on a startup at the time in London called OpenDesk, and we were having some troubles financially. And I started looking for a job. And, I think it was posted on Stack Overflow Careers. And I was like, what? I can use my Django and Docker and Python to make Marvel movies? That's insane. So, for me, it was an instant apply, right?
Yeah.
And I just wanted... to apply the knowledge I had as a software engineer into the visual effects industry. And for me, it was just mind-blowing that I was able to do it. And, when I joined Method Studios, it was a little bit of a shock because I think visual effects doesn't have a lot of people from outside the visual effects world building software. And, it just felt like, they were not following the best practices and et cetera. But they were very open for it. And I think, it did a very... It was really awesome and rewarding to push the company forward in the software engineering realm. And I think the same at ILM too. When I joined, I feel there was a lot of great stuff in place, but there was a lot of great opportunities for improvement too. And I think that was the challenge. How do we bring this, iconic 40 years old company to the future with Kubernetes, cloud, and all the buzzwords? And we did it, right? We are running workloads in Kubernetes and the cloud, and it's just, for me, has been amazingly rewarding being able to contribute to the companies while making visual effects, right? Our product is actually something that I watch at night when I go to cinema. And I enjoy it. And I can say, hey, I saw this before, or I know who worked on this in the credits, right? I think it's...
So you're actually reading, you know, as the credits go past, it always staggers me the number of people that are involved in making, you know, even a half hour program on, you know, whatever, like, but a full movie, it's just like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people.
That is just a small subset of the people. Like, usually not everybody gets credit. It's a little bit of a, you know, the client offers a certain space and then you put the people who contribute the most and whatnot. There's a lot of uncredited people too that are also a crucial part of those movies. It's an army. It takes an army.
So what would be, you know, people who use Django but are somewhat outside, what would improve things for you if Django, like, async, like if you could wave a wand and add something to Django or to a web thing, what specific to your workflows would be helpful?
I feel like we're still trying to figure out how to handle the UI side of things. You know, we build a lot of our front ends in React and then use, you know, Django REST framework for interacting with that. We don't use Django templates too much. You know, I feel like there's some areas that we want to explore on that front. Like, I heard you guys talk about XHTML a couple episodes ago.
HTMX.
HTMX. So I think that's just one area we need to explore a bit more.
I think from my side, when I see visual effects people trying to get into services, it can be a little bit intimidating, I think. You know, the deployment, for example, oh, do I need Unicorn? I need to know Nginx. I need to, like, I feel like Flask, for example, makes it very easy to have like a 10-line script that does the one function that people needed to do. And I really love how Django is better is included and people don't need to think about that. But almost like I would love if Django could also have like a simple mode or something like that that makes it, you know, I think maybe in the quick start / tutorial of the Django page, you could have another one that is like, you know, single page application with Django or single Python script application with Django, because you do have that in the doc somewhere.
Well, that two things. One is that we Django could and should improve the official thing, and the second is Carlton gave a keynote demonstrating this, and I have a package showing, actually, you know, instead of 6 lines, it's what, 15 lines to do with Django. So it's possible. It's just not typically used in that way. So it's more of a marketing problem, I think, than anything else.
There's two templates I'd like to create so that when you do start project, you can do these. And they'd have to be just put on GitHub. I just haven't got around to actually putting them on GitHub. And then you could point the start project command to them. But one is single file and the other is single folder. Because you can, that sort of sync, when you start app, or start project, sorry, you can just turn that into an app by adding a models file and adding the name of it to installed apps, and it turns into a fully featured app. But you haven't got then the project folder and then the app folder next to it, which is like, that seems like an awful lot of files for just one model that I want to create. Like, why are there so many files here? Like, and obviously as the project scales, that starts to, you know, that starts to pay dividends. But I think there's a lot of room for these kind of two, because the other example that makes me think about this is people doing data science with pandas and, you know, NumPy and all the rest. And they got their data set, they got their thing, and they just want to quickly wham it online and they end up using Flask, which is great. But from a Django perspective, it's like, well, why aren't you just using Django? Well, it's because there's too many files. Like, we should have a better story there.
I think, there's a bit of analysis paralysis, even like, how do I name stuff? Every time I start Django, it's like, should I name the project the same as the app? And it's like, I always get into that rabbit hole. It's like,
one thing we started doing in our team was setting up a cookie cutter template. And I'm hoping that crosses to all the other teams so that way our projects are standardized and everything looks the same.
That does help as well, because you get people able to move across teams and work on a different project, and because it looks the same, they don't spend that half a day going, where is everything?
100%.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, we've recently had a discussion about starter projects in Django, because there's a couple that are paid now that usually add billing and stuff, but there's Cookie Cutter, and then I have one Django X, and I think Django itself, if there was a starter project that could be deployed, because part of the problem is, you know, it's local development in Django, and it's quite the, since I teach this, it's quite the leap to get to deploying something, and that loses a lot of people. So even if it was something that was just a switch you could toggle that had some basic stuff that you could deploy the, what is it? The polls app, Carlton, you know, like there is a, there is probably a way to do that, or certainly to have something where it's just environment variables and it just switches debug, secret key, and allowed hosts, which gets you most of the way there.
Yeah, and it's interesting too on the lowering the barrier of entry, right? I think Django does a great job at saying like, you know, hey, in production, change this. Hey, this is not safe for production. But then when you have people just starting off, they're a bit scared and intimidated. Like, oh my God, I'm doing my local dev, but none of this is safe for production. So like, what am I doing? Where do I go from here? And I think maybe just saying the consequences too. And like, it is okay if your use case, you know, it's simple, you're disconnected from the internet, you're doing some local dev in a data center as a, you know, data scientist or visual effects artist. Like, you know, we are not touching the internet from our data center. So a lot of it, you know, matters, but doesn't really matter as much as if we were open to the whole world with our app. We're really trying just to, you know, develop a microservice to help with this workflow thing here that could just be a Python script in a server that I SCP and, you know, write a systemd to start. I don't know. I feel there's a lot of potential to simplifying and not,
Yeah, there's a, you know, there's the docs versus tutorials dilemma, which is that Django has docs, tutorials are separate. What, you know, people want tutorials. It would be nice to have Django tutorials, but they're a little bit more opinionated than the docs. So
100%. Yeah,
but also there's that problem with open source projects in that people think of a project like Django and they think of it like an organization like Industrial Light and Magic, and it's anything but. It's like half a dozen people giving their spare time, and it, you know, it's not a corporation. It's not a thing that has capacity to do everything. So it's a question of what gets done 100%. On in the time, and it's interesting. But yeah,
for what it's worth, we don't also. So
yeah. is that what's the business case thing as well? Like,
right. I do think for visual effects and machine learning and data science as well, and you know, Django has started recently, or you know, maybe I haven't followed much. Sorry, but all the async stuff and doing long running processes. For example, we usually use Django with salary, and setting that up and the infrastructure can be a little bit too much. If there was like a simple thing too that, you know, maybe bake all of that in and, you know, not performant as salary or scalable, but at least it, you could run some async stuff and some sort of queues. I think, you know, Fast API has a class that does that. I think Tornado has something that does it too, because it's just async IO and Flask. Granted, I haven't been following that too much in the Django side. It might already be there, but I think that would be helpful.
No, I mean, Starlet, the framework which underlies Fast API, it allows these background tasks where you can just sort of spin it off and go. And what it doesn't have is like the retries and the, you know, task acknowledgements and all those kind of extra things, which is when you need a proper queue. And yes, Celery is the big beast in the room, and it's old and gnarly and whatnot, but it's super powerful if you can get it. It's a difficult one. There've been many attempts at a simple queues. But yes, that's another one that's always sort of on the list as a goodie.
James, can I ask with the permissions on the web GUIs, how complex do you all get with your permissions? Are you using like groups in Django? Are you doing it at the API level? Like, how are you setting that up, if you know?
Yeah, so typically like our Django apps, they'll interact with some of our internal APIs, and they usually handle a lot of the authentication. It doesn't, as Andre mentioned, like a lot of our tools don't touch the internet, and we're a very open studio. So I think it depends on the application itself. Like, for example, that subscription management tool I was talking about, our permissions on that are open, so users can log into other users and mess with their settings. But, you know, no one does that because it's an internal company, and, you know, we don't hire any trolls that go in and mess with those. So and having that open atmosphere in our tools makes it easier for us to debug things. So we can have somebody on our production team help a supervisor and just log into their account and see what's going on, if that makes sense.
Carlton, I'm trying to remember, there's a really nice third-party package in Django where you can log in as any user,
Yeah. Yeah. Django Hijack. Hijack, the one that's I would use if I had to go.
That is a
because you know, cause all the time someone says it doesn't work bad. For me.
Suddenly thinking it sounds bad, but yeah, that enables you an admin, a staff user, to log in as another account via a button in the admin, and then they can just sort of log out of that. And that can be really important because you've got a customer who's struggling, and they're like, "This is what I'm seeing," and you're like, "But it works for me." And to be able to step, you know, with their permission, obviously, step into their account and step through the things and see what's going on, that can solve it, because you're like, "No, this doesn't happen. This is fine. This works. Silly customer." And until you actually do it, and then you're like, "Oh, there is a bug, you know, they've got an accent over the one of the letters in their name, and of course that crashes the app because, you know, we're Anglo-Saxon programs and we never considered that." Like, you know, any number of problems can come up. But yeah, that kind of process is good. I like what you were talking about there, James, about how it's an internal tool and the way you can balance what your threat model. Your threat model is not, you know, hackers on the internet. The threat model is, I don't know, we spill coffee on the server. That's, you know, that's a silly example, but you know, you can grade, you know, what level of protection you put on by what's realistically something that your application needs to handle.
Yeah, absolutely. We do have some internal checks to keep people from seeing things they're not supposed to, because we do compartmentalize, you know, some projects we're working on. But for the most part, it's pretty open, and that makes debugging very easy. The software management system we have that allows sim linking also makes it very easy to see what the user is seeing. So if, for example, an artist is working on their own script and they're like, "It's not working, can you help me?" It's very easy just to sim link it from their home dir to my home dir and pick it up.
And then that's like live coding, right? So you make some edits, it immediately appears back on there. That's super. I mean, you know, exactly. Like the IDE developers are only just getting to that now.
Yeah. So, yeah, we were looking at VS Code, was it LiveShare a little bit? But since we're air-gapped, it doesn't quite work for us.
Yeah, the JetBrains folks have very similar code with me, I think theirs is called.
We're close on time. Are there any bits we didn't get in?
I think just to stress that we are hiring. We have a lot of openings. If any of this interests you, please apply. If in doubt, apply anyways. I'm sure our recruiters will get back to you and we'll figure something out.
Well, surely this audience is yours. And you're like, you can use your Django skills to build, like, you know, Marvel films.
Yeah,
movies,
no more boring crud apps. Like, work on Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Everybody apply. We'll put the link for that in the show notes.
Yeah, no, we will. We will for sure. Well, thank you both so much for taking the time. And thank you, I think, Andre, for, I think we connected on Twitter. Someone had put out, I forget, a tweet about Django in the real world. And you said, "Hey, we're using it over here." And that's how this started. So,
yeah, of course. Thank you for connecting too. Yeah. No, it's been awesome. Yeah, it was a, what's the name of the book, Spad?
Which one? The Django for Will's books?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Django for Beginners, Professionals, and APIs. Yeah, those books were huge help. So
thank you
for that.
Very happy to hear that.
Well, you should offer an ILM discount.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if they want bulk, I know. I need to. No, it is actually, there are, I know for a number of companies that for new recruits, you know, my books and some others, you know, just to onboard people who know Python, but I have no idea how to do Django. There's still not that many resources actually on it. So yeah, if any companies want to do that, hit me up.
I think if you want to get someone up to speed in, like, you know, sit down, read these, that's the way to go. You know, your books are.
Yeah,
definitely.
I'll plug Adam Johnson's books too, are fantastic when you get to the next.
Sure, but they're next. They're follow up.
The DX and Speed Up Your Django Tests. And there's other materials, but generally people write books kind of more at the level they are at, whereas to write beginner stuff is less interesting as you progress in your own journey. So,
yeah, I just finished his book. It was great.
Yeah, anything he writes, recommend. Again, thank you both so much for coming on. We are at djangochat.com, chat Django on Twitter. We'll have notes to everything in the show notes. So see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you both. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, guys.